are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Chuck Thompson warns that we should be wary of much of what travel journalists tell us because much of their work is supported by the travel industry. Travel writers often describe a world of white sand beaches, quaint villages, and smiling locals eager to share their secret knowledge. But Mr. Thompson suggests that everything isn't as idyllic as they make it seem. He's called his new book from Henry Holt, Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer. I'm very pleased it has brought Chuck Thompson to the show today. Hello.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How long have you been a travel writer?
About 10 years, 10 or 12 years was about 12 years ago. One of the first gigs I had was coming out to New York, actually, to do some things at the Rose Museum. When the Rose Museum just opened in Carnegie Hall, I did a thing on that for an in-flight magazine, actually, for American Airlines. That was probably one of the first travel bits I did.
And you were a founding editor of Travelocities magazine. Why didn't that last very long?
Well, that's an entire chapter of the book, and there are a lot of complicated explanations. But, well, the easy one is that it's just really hard to get any kind of travel magazine off the ground, and Travelocity and Expedia attempted to launch newsstand magazines at the exact same time, about a year almost to the date before 9/11, and there was, as you probably recall, a massive downturn in travel and travel advertising and just general travel right after that. And both those magazines were struggling to find readers anyway, up against, you know, the heavyweights, the Travel and Leisure, Geographic Adventure, Connash Traveler, and that kind of put them both under.
You open your book with a description of an article you read in Harper's by Sally Tisdale. In it, she eviscerated contemporary travel writing. What were her complaints?
That's a terrific piece. Came out about 10 years ago. And I think
just as you were starting?
Yeah, right when I was getting in the business. It was called Why Travel Writers Should Stay at Home, I think. Her major complaints were about, you know, most travel writers get sent out to do stories and to invent stories and invent adventures where nothing existed before, to write about themselves. And they also, because so much travel writing you read, even from magazines or publications that tell you that, you know, we never accept comps, we will never accept a freebie, so that you know that our words are pure and genuine and this is the unvarnished truth. Well, they don't have to accept comps because they're accepting a lot of money from advertisers. And it's really the big advertising accounts that are going to sort of draw or you know, push the editorial focus. And what you end up getting is a lot of copy that has been variously described as, by travel writers I know, witless puffery and sun-dappled barf, you know, this sort of shimmering sands and golden beaches kind of thing. And that was one of her complaints as well, and mine.
But I don't understand. If it's just ads, if they're not really getting the free hotel and the free ride on the yacht and the balloon and whatever else they are writing about, then why can't they be honest? What's the difference? Is it the editors who are concerned that they might chase away advertisers?
Well, any magazine in particular, I mean, it's not if the readers don't keep it in business, the advertisers do, right? Everybody knows that. So it's sort of one of these tacit understandings that you're not going to want to upset a, let's say, in fact, I have in my bag here an example of a Conde Nast Traveler where they did a big spread on Singapore. And the visitsingapore.com, the Singapore Tourist Board, whatever they call themselves, and Singapore Airlines, I think they took out 4 or 5 full-page ads in this publication. I have no idea what Conde Nast's ad rate is, but I'll bet you they're making upwards of 6 figures for those ads. Nobody needs to be told that we don't want to upset Visit Singapore, just spent a lot of money on this. And furthermore, if you look at the advertisements that visitsingapore.com is running in that magazine and elsewhere, they're trying to push things like the ethnic neighborhoods of Singapore and the new fashion industry of Singapore to get over this idea that Singapore, you know, the negative reputation of Singapore is it's this kind of sterile, boring city in the midst of the raucous Southeast Asia. So they're trying to push these vibrant ethnic neighborhoods. Well, you look at their ads, that's what they say, and then you look at the content of the stories, it's the exact same thing.
I always thought that the problem with Singapore was that it was kind of autocratically run and that if you chewed gum or if you did anything else, you might...
Is that a problem for you, sir?
Well, I don't chew gum, but I don't like the idea that they throw people in jail for that sort of thing or fine them. And they remember they whipped that American kid? He scratched a car. Well, I think that you shouldn't scratch a car, but I'm not sure that that's the best solution. So they're painting a happy face on this city that has kind of hard and fast rules.
Well, that's one way of putting it. Or they're sort of doing the advertiser's bidding. If I may say, I actually like to I like Singapore. I think it doesn't quite deserve the negative reaction that it gets either. I've been there. I've got friends there. It's a fun vibe. Boy, it's a great eating town, and it's a great nightlife town. It's a terrific place to go out. The Singaporeans are very friendly, sociable people.
I hear that the Singapore Airlines is terrific, but I remember that Singapore girl, you're a great way to fly, and that always upset the more feminist, social conscious side of me. Another complaint that you have with travel writing is that the industry has a series of go-to adjectives that they use repeatedly in travel writing. Cozy, magical, hip, happening, sun-drenched, undiscovered, just a few of them. I'm sure that there are others that drive you crazy. Have you been able to avoid using those adjectives in your writing?
Not entirely, and that's part of what drove the book. I mean, some of those adjectives are pulled right out of my own clip file. I'll admit to it, you know. The one that always bothers me a lot is the magical combination of the old and new and the historic and the current. I mean, as if every place on Earth couldn't make that claim. I mean, as I say in the book, you could say that about my backyard is a magical blend of the ancient and the modern, right? So that's another one of those catchphrases that bothers me. But no, I've used them. And, you know, it's a kind of writing, it's a style of writing that's evolved, I think, especially over the last 15, 20 years, that has more to do with, it's the language of writers groping for the words of advertisers, and they don't do it particularly well, and that's what it ends up being. It ends up being boring, and it's not a way that anybody speaks normally. It's not a way that they even think about travel, really. Not too many people really think about travel in those terms, and yet those are the terms over and over that were fed in modern contemporary travel writing, and I just kind of dislike it.
That it's magical. I mean, I can't imagine anybody, no matter how happy they are in Provence or in Florence, saying, gee, this is magical.
You bring up magical. I just, there's an Islands magazine. It's on the newsstands now. There's a woman that writes a bit about walking into her hotel room that she's getting. And literally the line is something like, I felt as though I'd opened the closet of Narnia and entered a magic world. I mean, she's literally describing walking into her hotel room.
Wow. I'm always pleased when the TV works and the bed isn't too small.
Exactly.
And the bathroom is clean. By the way, if you want to join into this conversation, we invite you to give us some comments on our comments line and on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, if you have something really, really great to tell us, you can give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. My guest is Chuck Thompson. He's written a book called Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer, which is published by Henry Holt. You also claim that the editors of travel pieces feel they have to dumb down the copy. Has that been something you've experienced?
Yeah, I've definitely experienced it. You know, nobody has ever used that word. I've never heard the word lowest common denominator or dumbed down. Nevertheless, it just sort of comes through in a message. I mean, when you work at magazines, there's always a discussion among editors and people that work there about our readers. The fact is nobody really knows who our readers are. I mean, do you know exactly who our listeners are on WNYC? I mean, there is no one.
I know the listener.
You do? I bet you the listener
My
that
cousin
you know.
Joe.
I'll bet you the listener that you would describe that you're listening to now is probably a little different than maybe your producer or the guy down the hall or somebody listening would describe.
Well, we actually meet listeners, not all of our listeners, but we meet them at events, so we have some sense. But it's true. When I open up one of those travel magazines, it says best hotels in the world. I wonder who is going to go to those hotels. Is this the equivalent of what they call food porn, where people buy cookbooks that have recipes that are impossible to make, but they like to fantasize them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of what drives the editorial of travel magazines is what's called aspirational travel. There's this idea out there that the public can't get enough of looking at photographs of hermetically sealed hotel suites that go for $1,600 a night. Personally, that's not my... I could care less about seeing that sort of stuff. I mean, I suppose it's nice once in a while, but I don't need to look at it constantly.
A listener writes that every time she goes to Asian countries, she hires a guide, and they feel as though they have to westernize the experience. On a recent trip to Vietnam, the same thing happened, and she was taken to westernized Vietnamese restaurants where the food was awful. But when she complained and the guide brought it to places where the locals eat, the food was fantastic and cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So what about those guides? I know I've had that experience in Mexico where I said, where should I go? And they said, Carlos E. Charlie. I said, no. Would you read Carlos E.
Tequila Willie's. Well, I just came back from the Congo, actually, and had the exact same experience. I normally don't like to hire guides. I like to do everything independently. But there's a few places that intimidate me a little bit. So I hired a guy to take me around for a while. The first three or four meals we had were French cuisine. It was, you know, steak frites and or Belgian food or whatever. And it, you know, actually, it wasn't too bad, I thought. But it wasn't anything that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. And I complained to him a little bit. And by far, the best meals that we had were some, you know, local chicken and weird sauces that I'd never had, peanut sauces and things like that were fantastic.
Getting back to the dumbing down, have you ever turned in an honest piece and then had it edited so much you didn't recognize it?
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. Well, I won't say didn't recognize it, but the most egregious edit I had, and I'm not going to name the magazine or the editor because it's a guy I really like, but I was sent down to a carnival in Trinidad, and it was an amazing experience. It was one of the best single events. I'll say this, if of those sort of do it before you die lists, Carnival Trinidad was in the top three or four single events I've ever experienced. Really had an amazing time. And one of the things that, of the many things down there that you notice, is there is a very open sense of sexuality and atmosphere of sexuality in the dancing and the costumes and the behavior. And I mentioned this in the lead paragraph of my story. And I remember when the story came out, I can't remember what I said. I said something about dancing and simulated copulation or something. It was a little bit academic, but for a humorous purpose in some way. And anyway, the magazine changed it to, I see people making whoopee on the side or something. Anyway, the term making whoopee got inserted for my little joke. And to this day, I sort of cringe thinking about somebody throwing making whoopee and for copulation, you know.
Well, you write that the editors of most travel magazines reject out of hand the more interesting travel stories.
I think the more interesting travel stories are the more truthful ones and the more truthful.
You mean the horror
ones.
Stories?
Not necessarily the horror stories. They're ones that are both good and bad, right? I mean, if you go on any trip, you're going to come back with, this was great, but this was horrible. And the fact is, people want to hear about the horrible part.
Well, they want to be warned.
Yeah, they want to be warned. I was just at a party over the holidays where a guy was telling me about his horrendous shopping excursion in Morocco and the Moroccan markets where the salesmen are just literally grabbing at you physically. And people couldn't get enough of hearing. He enjoyed telling the story. It's probably serves as both a warning, a bit of a catharsis. And I think in a way, too, travel really confers some sense of status on people. You know, one of the reasons that we travel to certain places is the same reason that we choose a type of music to buy or a type of furniture to put our house in. It's a reflection of us. And the guy that gets to go to Morocco and has this story, I mean, there's a little bit of bragging rights behind it, right? And people like that. And the stories are of trials and tribulations, and they're fun to hear.
I'm going to sneak in a call before we go to the break. Elizabeth from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
I actually work in advertising. I'm actually a travel rep for a magazine, and I just wanted to make a quick clarification. I guess the days of church and state are definitely over, but I think you may have had the order incorrect in certain circumstances. A lot of times the editor will come to a rep or the advertising team and tell them, you know what, we're writing up Singapore in the next issue, which then allows the rep to go back to the client and say, you know what, we're writing you up. This is a great issue for you to come into. So it's not necessarily taking care of advertisers that have already spent. So,
But Elizabeth, now I have no reason to defend Chuck Thompson here, but I also used to work in advertising. And what I get out of this is there's an understanding from the advertiser that the magazine is going to do right by the client. Otherwise, they're never going to advertise in that magazine again.
That's not always been my experience, but I do understand what you're saying.
Well,
So what happens when the client says, you had us put millions of dollars or thousands of dollars of ads into this magazine, and they're ripping up our client?
I see what you're saying. Negative press.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess there is an implicit.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, there's something else too, Elizabeth, which is that I think it does work both ways. And I've been in that situation where Edit did go and do that. But why do you think Edit goes to the ad people to say, hey, here's something we can sell? You know, look at the current issue, this One of Islands magazine that's on the stands now. It's their romance issue, right? Flip through that and you're going to find about 10 or 15 different ads from major accounts with romance themes. Those advertisers didn't build brand new accounts just because Islands was about to do a package. Islands did a package because those accounts existed.
We're going to take a little break here. Thank you so much for calling us, Elizabeth. My guest is Chuck Thompson, who's written for Maxim, The Atlantic, Esquire, National Geographic, Adventure, Playboy, Spy, and other publications. And he's written a book called Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer. It's published by Henry Holt. We will continue and be taking more of your calls after this. We're back with Chuck Thompson, whose book is called Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer, published by Henry Holt. As much a memoir as it is a book about travel writing, but then again, travel writing is often kind of memoir, or as you say, Chuck, memoir that's been gussied up to make everybody a little happy. But you write about some locations in your book that you say are overrated. Mm. The Caribbean, for example, you call it a miasmic hellscape. New Zealand, a junior varsity version of the Pacific Northwest. Austin, if it wasn't surrounded by Texas, it'd be called Sacramento. And Colorado, you say Kansas with big hills. Well, you know, Kansas is right next to Colorado.
Right.
Those are a couple. Now, why don't people go to the Caribbean because they want to loll on a nice, clean beach with wonderful blue water, and go to Colorado because they want to ski?
Well, here's my issue with the Caribbean. I'm not trying to tell anybody else not to like the Caribbean. And one of the things, the subtitle of this book is Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer. And one of the confessions part of that is, if you're a travel writer and you admit that you don't like the Caribbean, that's just not a very smart thing to do. Las Vegas is another place that I list as one of the ones that I don't really love. I'm just not one of these guys that cares to slather myself in oil and lay on a towel on a beach and try to read with the sun glaring in my eyes and the wind blowing sand in my face. I just never quite understood that type of vacation. The sea is beautiful. The snorkeling's fine. I'm sure the people are nice, although I have to say the service I've gotten in the Caribbean has tended to be pretty poor. I've never had that great of it. It's not one of these friendly, welcoming places, at least in my experience. I've only been down four or five times. But
well, what about Austin? That is, I mean, I agree with you about Austin. It's a college town.
Good. I'm glad, because you know what? The Austin, what is it, the Statesman Journal, whatever their paper down there is, complained about that line in their op-ed section last week. The college town part's fine. But yeah, it's a big college town. Look, here's my impression.
People drink a lot of beer.
Yeah,
when they're not in class.
Right. They do that in Boise and in Eugene, Oregon, and all that. And that was exactly my first impression when I got to Austin. I'd heard all these things, and I thought, well, it's a nice little town. There's a lot of great places to go drink. But it's at least, you know, I'm from the West Coast. I can name you 10 towns on the West Coast that are the exact same town.
We're going to put Susan on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hello?
Yes, Susan.
Hi, I'm also a travel writer. I love your comments. I think they're dry and they're real, and it's kind of similar to mine. I have been trying to get a book published. I am a two-book writer, author, and I'm being told over and over again that people are not interested in travel writing by publishers and agents. What's your comment on that?
I was told the same thing, probably.
Over and over and over again.
Mm. Yeah, and you know what the frustrating part about that is, Susan? Because I'm guessing that you go to the bookstore, like I was doing when I was pitching this book, and I saw these travel books.
Read all the
agents, and they're like, nah, no one's doing travel. They don't do travel. I got told that for about a year as well.
No, it's a wonderful genre. You know, travel writing. It's it's done well.
I agree, right? I think, yeah, I agree 100% with that comment. I guess my comment is, you know, I think anybody that's trying to sell a book on anything, whether it's sports or politics, I mean, people are always looking for a reason not not to pick up that book. I'm not sure that that's necessarily exactly true of more true of travel than anything else. But if it's any sort of consolation, I mean, I definitely was told the same thing for about a year before this book got out.
Thank you so much for calling us. We got an email from Stephen from Brooklyn who says he stopped traveling because he had an epiphany concerning how travel contributes to cultural imperialism and ecological waste. And he writes that the cult of the exotic is a myth, went to the jungles of Southeast Asia and bumped into Dunkin' Donut stands.
What's this guy's name?
Stephen.
Listen, I think the point Stephen makes is a really great one. And I think that it's missing from contemporary travel literature. And that's the exact kind of thing that I think we're missing the boat on that. Now, whether you agree or disagree with Stephen, I think it's a valid point. And I think it's one worth discussing and exploring. I grew up in Alaska, and there's a chapter in my book about the way that Juneau, which is now the cruise ship destination of summer for a lot of people, has really changed. I mean, the town, you know, literally sort of complicitly with the travel industry made over downtown. I mean, it got rid of all the bars and shops and this and that to put in gift shop, gift shop, gift shop, gift shop, big boardwalk, big boardwalk. All right, now that's fine. It brought in a lot of money to a lot of people in the town. And maybe, you know, turning a big portion of your city's economy over to tourism isn't a bad thing, but maybe it is a bad thing too. And I would just like to see, I don't agree 100% with what Stephen said, but I agree with some of it. And I think it definitely merits a discussion that doesn't get, we're not presented with that in the travel press.
Well, you say in this book that we find this so-called undiscovered place, and then everybody wants to go there because it's undiscovered, and we destroy it.
Yeah.
And now it's no longer has any of the appeal that drew people to it in the first place.
Yeah, and if this guy Stephen feels a little guilt about being part of that process, when you're a travel writer, you definitely feel that way. I've made a pact with myself. I no longer write about places in Alaska that haven't already been discovered. I don't want to be part of that anymore.
On the other hand, we got an email from Naomi who says that as a freelance travel writer herself, she's taken comps, but it has never stopped her from being honest. She says that she dissed a certain famous rodent for the Boston Herald and had hot stones dropped on her head at a spa, wrote about the experience, still gets invited to places that are otherwise out of her price range. Her most loathed, overused phrase is, which she admits to having used, is nestled.
Oh, nestled! I was gonna, when you were reading off the description, and I was gonna throw nestled in there. If you pick up the book, you'll find nestled on my list of hated terms. That's great. That's funny that you put that.
But she's saying that it doesn't matter whether you say negative things; people will still invite you. I guess it's only if you get a reputation for always saying negative.
Well, here's the thing, and some people are disappointed with my answer when they ask about this. They often want give us the conspiracy, give us the truth. They want me to say resort A paid publication B to tell lie C, and it doesn't work that way. And I don't know, I haven't read her piece, but I'll bet you I bet the hot stone dropping on her head was presented as a sort of humorous anecdote that was other than this, boy, what a fantastic experience. You know, I would bet dollars to Dunkin' Donuts that was the way that went down.
My guest is Chuck Thompson. His book, Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer, is published by Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm always afraid that I'm going to be labeled an ugly American just because I have an American accent. And there is that concern. You make any kind of faux pas, and it matters a lot more if you're an American on vacation.
Matters now more than ever, and I think Americans are increasingly becoming aware of that. And it's funny, too, what travel does to your sense of being an American. In some ways, it makes you a little more patriotic. I mean, even I was going to say even the most lefty liberal or the most anti-current administration among us, of which I count myself, it really rubs you the wrong way to be standing on a castle turret, as I was in Germany last summer, and hearing a bunch of foreigners, non-Americans, really trashing America, assuming that, you know, it's sort of keeping you in the conversation, but I mean, really running things down. And you do feel this weird sense of, wow, I need to defend this place that, you know, it's kind of like somebody, making fun of your alcoholic uncle. It's like, well, we in the family can do that, but, you know, you don't. So it does that to it. But I think, too, just traveling as an American in recent years, a lot of people have asked me, you know, if things have gotten worse out there, if it's a little more dangerous. I certainly haven't felt too much anti-Americanism coming at me simply because I was American. However, I do notice this. 20 years ago, when you went overseas with your little blue American passport, it instantly made you the most popular guy in the room, whether you were in Europe or Asia or South America. People, you're American. Hey, come here, my American. You know, they like partially because they knew you had money, but also they really...
They love Yanks.
They did, yeah. And you don't get that anymore.
What about the travel guides? Do you think any of them work well?
Yeah, I think most of them work pretty well. I mean, they're all geared for the people that they're, you know, whether it's Fodor's or Moon Publications or Lonely Planet.
They never seem to have the restaurant I want to go to.
Well, the problem with restaurants is, you know what the publication timeline is. By the time somebody writes something down in a field notebook in Brazil, brings it back, it gets that and it's published, it's 8 months old, and the entire staff at the restaurant is now turned over. There's two new chefs, a new maitre d', whatever. So restaurants are always really tough for
so
that.
So for that, the internet.
I think so. I think the internet on just about all of these things anymore is you know, replacing that as the go-to source of current information.
Why do you object to Paul Theroux's travel writing?
Well, can I rephrase the question or
okay,
ask it?
Sure.
I certainly don't object to his travel writing. I think Paul Theroux is the great American traveler of the jet age, travel writer of the jet age. I think his books are fantastic. I tell people to read Paul Theroux's books all the time. I made the point in the book that to show the difference between travel books and good travel writing and travel fluff writing for magazines. And when Paul Theroux does his stuff for travel magazines, often he falls into the same sort of traps that most travel magazine writers fall into, which is writing more copy that's more seems more. Boy, I don't want to get in trouble with Paul Theroux here, but it's chirpy happy, more of the chirpy happy talk copy than you get in his books.
Well, you get that from those cable travel shows as well, Riddy Maxa and Rick Steves.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that there's no way that they could have afforded to do the things that they do. They're taking balloon rides and they're private yacht rides,
yeah, right,
down rivers, and they're staying at these 17th century chateaus.
Yeah, the balloon ride. You're always getting pushed balloon rides in these travel. Have you ever taken a balloon ride on a trip?
I would if I could afford that sort of thing.
Would you? I don't know. It seems like a hassle.
I was in a helicopter once. It was really exciting.
Yeah. Oh, I guess in Amsterdam, the balloon rides are pretty easy and a big deal. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm the same way as you. I don't know who's doing this stuff or even why they'd want to do this stuff. It's not how I travel.
You also don't like B&Bs. People have so much affection for B&Bs.
I know. I'm cranky on B&Bs. When I travel, I shouldn't admit this is yet another bad thing to say if you're a travel writer, but I like to be left alone, man. I want to, when I travel, I just, let me do my thing. I don't like people coming and pestering me. I don't really want to sit at breakfast and start talking to strangers. And I really dislike, man, once I got out of the college dorms, I said, that's the last shared bathroom I'm doing, you know?
Gordon writes that he's planning a trip to Peru. He's checked out several travel guides from the New York Public Library, and they all push guided tours.
Mm. Wow. My sister just got back from New York 2 days ago from 6 months in Peru. I wish she was sitting here. She could answer this question for us. I've never been to Peru, and I don't know. I would think that that's probably unnecessary in Peru. I know I think to get to Machu Picchu, you probably have to join a tour group. I think you have to hike in there with a group or, you know, go in there on a bus. But I would suspect that you could probably fly yourself down to Lima, spend a couple of days. You know, it depends how many days you have. Get your feet wet and figure it out. If you've only got probably 10 days and you want to see the whole country, probably a guided tour makes sense. But if you've got more time than that, I tend to avoid them.
Another person writes that it seems as though travel magazines only write to the wealthy. Where can you go to find information about a city or a location other than the promotions that they provide? He says that the New York Times recently listed the best places to go when visiting Prague and many others. It was all about star-level hotels and restaurants.
You want to know why that they do that? It's because those are the advertisers that can afford the freight for these publications. I worked for a number of years for a magazine called Escape, came out of Los Angeles. And for better or worse, it was attempting to be sort of the Lonely Planet of the magazine world. I was trying to appeal to that a little more, you know, down market or less affluent audience.
Although you don't love Lonely Planet guides either.
I don't. They're really pompous. I think they do their job well. I think their details and their facts are A+. I mean, I don't think any guidebooks are more accurate than those. I just can't stand their attitude about telling me how to behave in the face of locals and where to throw my trash. And anyway, the reason that Escape failed, even though it was quite a good magazine, was there are no the types of people that do that type of travel, they don't stay in the big hotel chains. They'd rather go stay in the little guest house. They don't eat in the five-star restaurant overlooking the river. They go to the little back alley noodle shop. And so they just can't get advertisers to pay for that type of travel writing.
Just one more thing. Debbie writes, what do you advise travelers regarding places like Cancun, where she was pulled over this past summer by police for going 5 miles above the speed limit and told that she could pay $200 mm-hmm. or go to the police station? You just came back from Congo, mm-hmm. one of the most dysfunctional places in the world. How do you get past the corruption and all the other and the dangers?
There's a whole section in this book about that, and I would say, particularly in Cancun, make friends with the cop, joke around with him a little bit, and be his buddy, and by the end of it, he'll take $5 and leave.
So you got to pay the bribe. It's just a small
bribe. Oh, yeah, you got to pay it. I mean, look, these guys aren't getting paid by their payment is the uniform and the badge and maybe the gun. The government's not paying these guys salaries. I mean, how they make money is getting $5 and $10 off you here and there.
So I'm not going to ask you why Eric Clapton bothers you so much.
Good, but, thank you.
But
we'd be besieged with callers.
So many listeners want to know if you could go anywhere right now, today, just pack a bag and go somewhere, where would you go?
I'm going to cheat and say two things, which I always say to this, is London and the Philippines. Those are my two favorite places to travel, and obviously for very different reasons.
Anywhere in the Philippines? That's a...
Yeah, it's a big
bunch
place.
Of islands.
I'm partial to an island called Leyte, which is where the big General MacArthur Monument is down there. I think it's quite unspoiled and just a real nice place. I like Mindanao quite a lot. There's a lot of outdoorsy activity stuff. There's the largest peak in the Philippines is there, Mount Apo. There's a lot of culture there.
And,
like Mindanao.
And London when the pound is in $2.
Good Lord.
Chuck Thompson.
I don't know if I'll ever see London again, right?
Chuck Thompson's book, Smile When You're Lying, Confessions of a Rogue Travel Writer, published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.